Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Australian conductor Simona Young, who makes her debut on the podium at the San Francisco Symphony this week, conducting music of Ravel and Rimsky-Korsakov. American filmmaker Luke Lorenzen stops by to share details about Midnight Family, his documentary about a family running a private ambulance service in Mexico City, currently at the San Francisco International Film Festival. Also, Macedonian filmmakers Tamara Kotevska and Lubomir Stefanov discuss their visually stunning documentary, Honeyland, about the last female beekeeper in a remote village in the Balkans. Rose Aguilar talks with choreographer Joe Kreider about her new project, The Weight Room, a site-specific dance honoring women with incarcerated loved ones. It's a work that blends oral history, dance, original music and soundscape by Pamela Z, and public art in an exploration of the physical, psychic, and emotional burdens of prison for women with incarcerated loved ones. Plus, from the San Francisco Ballet, I'll talk with theremin player Carolina Eich, who performs in John Neumeier's ballet The Little Mermaid, set to music by Russian-American composer Lyra Auerbach. All ahead here on Open Air. Well, if you open this week's Pink Pages from the Chronicle, their datebook section for all things cultural for the week and beyond, you'd be greeted on page 5 by display ads from two of our prominent arts organizations in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Ballet and the San Francisco Opera, that both feature water nymphs. Well, the opera is presenting Dvorak's Rusalka in June, based on ancient tales in Dvorak's homeland of Bohemia. And tomorrow evening is the opening night for The Return of the Little Mermaid, with music by Lyra Auerbach and choreography by John Neumeier, last seen here in 2010, based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. Back in 2010, I talked with conductor Martin West about the score to that ballet. This time around, I spoke with the theremin player, visiting artist Carolina Eich, who has a prominent role in the score. We began our chat in one of the rehearsal halls for a brief demonstration of the theremin. It was just before a full rehearsal of the ballet orchestra, so this field recording will also include a prominent trumpeter warming up in the background. We later moved to a more conducive setting for conversation. So we're going to start with a little demonstration of the theremin that Carolina's doing. With her left hand, she's keeping it down to her left of the instrument, which is a hoop portion of the antenna, and it does what?
The left side does the volume. So when I'm close to the antenna, there's silence, and then when I go away from the antenna, I get a louder sound.
And then the right antenna is a vertical antenna with your right hand, and that adjusts the pitch. Is that correct?
Right. The closer I go to the antenna, the higher the pitch gets.
So now we're in a quieter space away from the rehearsal and the musicians warming up for today's rehearsal for The Little Mermaid. This score was written in 2005 by the Russian composer Lyra Auerbach to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the Hans Christian Andersen tale. And through a new ballet with choreography by the great John Neumeier, were you at all involved in that creation of the score?
No, not really, but I met the composer, of course, and so, yeah, I played it first in Hamburg, where The Little Mermaid was premiered. And then we went also on tour in Japan for 3 weeks with the ballet.
So you've been involved with it since its creation, though?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
When you're playing with a group like the ballet orchestra, it sometimes must be daunting to deal with an instrument for which you can't rely on a string or a button to press and be confident that that certain note will come out, but rather having to literally conjure the sound out of thin air. Now, given the nature of the beast of the theremin, so to speak, is there some leeway for accuracy in pitch for this particular score? Is it sound effect, or are there specific notes that you have to hit?
It's very specific, so I better hit all my notes. No, we have really fine and defined melodies for the theremin in this score, and also some glissando effects, which are, you know, very natural for the instrument. I do play certain pitches. Like, I have a technique where I can hit my notes, and precisely. So,
in fact, you developed the technique and literally wrote the book that theremin players mm-hmm. use now for accurately hitting pitches in the air.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So, yeah, when I was about 15, 16, I came up with a precise playing technique, which involves that you can measure air with your hand. So one distance of a hand will be an octave, and you adjust the field of the theremin to your hand so that it's really precise, and every time I play, the notes are in the same space, in the same spot. And then it gives me 13 different positions for 13 notes within one octave.
That's fascinating that theremin himself didn't develop that technique, and they're different sizes, so everyone must compensate to a certain degree in those positions.
Well, you can adjust the field to your body, so it doesn't really matter if you have big hands or small hands. Oh. Well, the instrument itself has developed, so if you imagine a violin string, then the higher the pitches go, the closer the distances are to each other. But my instrument, which came out in 2006, I think, was the last thing that Robert Moog invented or built before he died. And with my instrument I have right now, it's that the spacing between the notes are almost the same. It's like on the piano. So I have a linear field, so to say. That makes it easier to find the notes and to be able to measure the notes in the air.
And in spite of there not being anything really visual for you to rely on, that's mm-hmm. it's absolutely fascinating. And again, the closer you are to the instrument, the antenna, the higher the pitch when you think of the shortness of your body between the object. It's just a shorter field, so to speak. The distance.
Oh, yeah, that was with the old instruments. So now with a new instrument, we have similar spacing between the notes.
Interesting. Theremin designed his eponymous instrument to be sort of an instrument of the people, and imagined that every home mm-hmm. would have one like a piano. Turned out to be quite difficult to play and a great challenge to master. Now, what caused your parents to introduce you to this instrument at the age of 7?
My parents had been playing electronic music for a long time already, and they played it in concerts. And they thought that they would like to have a theremin for their band. And then they bought one, and they realized that it was not too easy to play, and you need some practice. So I had time, and they gave the instrument to me.
You mentioned that the instrument has developed somewhat, but there are always be two elements, the hoop on the left and the antenna on the vertical antenna on the right. But does the development of the instrument include just expanding the types of sounds and electronic add-ons, so to speak?
First of all, we got more octaves. Like, the range is really, like, endless and almost at the moment. And, yeah, the first instruments which were built had about 3 or 4 octaves. Then, of course, the sound has changed because the electronic components have changed as well. And the biggest change was probably, yeah, the field itself, which is now, yeah, a linear field. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you yourself have several instruments.
I do have 3 instruments, yes, but I travel mainly with my...
This is one.
Yeah.
You've commissioned a number of works for the instrument, including sonatas with piano written by Christopher Turnau, with whom you now tour. And the concerts also include more familiar works.
Yeah, I'm happy to see that composers are more and more interested in the theremin and are writing for the instrument. So we have these beautiful sonatas by Christopher Turnau, and of course different pieces for theremin and orchestra, like theremin concertos. I think like the sound of the theremin mixes very well with the orchestra sound. Sometimes it can float on top, or sometimes it can give this really great bass from below, and I think it mixes very well.
But more familiar tunes like the Swan of Camille Saint-Saëns, or the Ave Maria, all lend itself very well, and almost anything vocal would seem to lend itself very well to the theremin.
Yes. In my performances, I adapt pieces from the cello, from violin. So the Swan is a classic, right? It fits really well to the instrument.
In showbiz, timing is everything, and you've scheduled a recital in Berkeley next Friday on a night that the ballet is dark. Also a theremin workshop, which you'll be doing here in San Francisco, I believe. You did one in Chicago last week, in fact, Amsterdam and Berlin and beyond next month. Are you sensing a resurgence of instrument in potential theremin players, or is this more of a curiosity of people coming to hear and see?
I think we have created more and more interest in the instrument because YouTube exists now these days, and we are creating more videos that people can see that the theremin is actually playable, and there is a technique for it, and we have more and more players who play beautiful music, and this is, I hope that people can see that there's a big potential of the theremin.
Well, you've contributed so much to the instrument and its development, and I'm sure to its interest of people around the world, especially via the YouTube videos. And I know you've got to get up to rehearsal, so I'll let you go. And so looking forward to your performances, your return performances here for The Little Mermaid with the ballet.
Thank you.
The Little Mermaid runs at the San Francisco Ballet, opens tomorrow evening and runs through the 28th. It does have a gentle warning that this is not, so to speak, your Walt Disney's Little Mermaid. There are some rather brutal scenes depicted, and 12 and under are not recommended. Let's hear a little bit of the wonderful talents of Carolina Icke performing on the theremin. Here's the Bacchianas Brasileiras of Heitor Villa-Lobos, perfectly suited for this very ethereal instrument. Thank you. amazing talent of Carolina Eich performing on the theremin, and she'll be with the San Francisco Ballet Opera Ballet Orchestra for performances of The Little Mermaid, music by Lyra Auerbach, through the 28th of this month, opening tomorrow night, sfballet.org. That incredible theremin being used in quite a few films as well. You may have heard it prominently in Nicolas Roche's score to Spellbound. Also, it's incredibly evocative film. Many science fiction films, of course, using the theremin. And how appropriate to continue open air this afternoon with a discussion of film. The San Francisco International Film Festival continues here in the Bay Area, as you've been hearing on these open airwaves and other programs on KLW. And today I'm pleased to be joined by three filmmakers whose documentaries are being screened this week. Midnight Family, set in Mexico City and directed by Luke Lorenzen. Welcome to you, Luke.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And Honeyland, set in Macedonia, co-directed by Lubo Stefanov and Tamara Kavetska. Greetings to and welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Of course. Lubo, co-director of Honeyland, has over 20 years of experience in development and production of documentaries related to environmental issues and human development. And worked with Tamara as a for the film Lake of Apples back in 2017. Tamara is from Macedonia and won the Best Balkan Film Award at the Tirana International Documentary Film Festival with her graduation documentary, Students. Welcome to you both, and I hope you're having a good experience while you're here in San Francisco.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, we arrived just yesterday, so we hope that will be a good experience.
Well, I hope so. Well, I hope we have some time to enjoy the incredible weather that we've had here. Honeyland was the surprise hit at Sundance, where it won three awards, including the World Cinema Documentary Grand Prize. It's a visually stunning human portrait that has something sweet for everyone. The brief synopsis, Hatidze lives with her ailing mother in the mountains of Macedonia, making a living cultivating honey using ancient beekeeping traditions. And when an unruly family moves in next door, what at first seems like a balm for her solitude becomes a source of tension when they, too, want to practice beekeeping while disregarding her advice. Who had the idea for this documentary to do this?
It came spontaneously. We, as you already mentioned during our introduction, this is not our first movie. While,
just gonna switch mics there. It's a little bit noisy. I know that's much better. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
while shooting our first documentary together, and with the same crew, we start searching this area which is shown in the film, and without clear idea of Atija's presence there. We didn't meet her before. We were just exploring the area. It's supposed to be an environmental documentary for the region, and while searching the area, we spotted those holes on the cliffs, which are her beehives, which was obviously artificial, and soon after we found this abandoned village with the only two inhabitants, Matija and her mother.
Mm, interesting. And Tamara, I've just seen stills. I haven't seen the film, but it's actually an incredible, stunning setting. I'm kind of curious about how the intrusion of the camera worked both on the main characters and the folks that came into the whole situation. Was it difficult to incorporate the cameras as the documentary is being made to make it still seem like the cameras aren't there?
Well, since it took us 3 years of shooting, and we usually worked with split teams. That's why we were like one director, one cinematographer worked with the family, the other group worked with Atija, so we switched. And that's how we managed to get so much material, so much precious moments. And we wanted to create a different feeling in Atija's world and in their world. So that's why in Atija's scenes, they're a lot calmer. they kind of reflect her own personality and silence of the place, let's say. And as we follow the newcomers, the camera is a lot more dynamic and just chaotic in a way. And it was a very big challenge to, like, of course, put this all together, seem like a fiction in a way, in the story, in the sense of creating the
dramaturgy.
Yeah, the dramaturgy, let's say. And this was the biggest challenge we wanted to achieve. If we can make these completely realistic moments and scenes look fiction-like, and kind of break the line between fiction and documentary.
Underlying the whole process is something called the Nagoya Protocol. Could you tell us how that influenced the development of the film itself? What is the Nagoya Protocol?
Okay. Nice question. obviously, this film, although it's a human real-life story, it has a very strong environmental message. On the first weeks of shooting, we shoot a scene where Atija, while taking out her honey, repeating to the bees, "Half for me, half for you," and that's her motto. Is actually the Nagoya Protocol, which is actually a principle of equal sharing or fair sharing of benefits between users, which are humans, and providers, which is nature, in this case bees, in order to ensure food security. This was a very, very important point for us, because today we're facing lots of environmental problems like never before, starting from climate change to biodiversity loss to lots of them. The one this film addresses is overusing of natural resources.
And this is enjoying two more screenings tomorrow at the Victoria Theater here in San Francisco, and then Saturday at the Berkeley Film Center. Congratulations. It's the New York Times called this a quiet, moving, observational documentary that is a heart-skipping thriller as well as a perfect encapsulation of humanity's catastrophic domination of nature. Tell me, you just came from a panel discussion of the film. Anything from that event that you'd like to share that the audience brought to or that came out?
Tamar? It was a very interesting discussion, actually, especially because the audience still... Not all of them have watched the film, but probably none of them, but they saw a couple of scenes, and they were very interested in the subject and very interested to know about our experience shooting this film. I would also like to mention the other film, even though I'm not sure about the name.
I'm also not sure about the name. Yeah. It's about a similar isolated woman somewhere in Iceland.
The name of the film is The Seen and the Unseen.
The Seen and... Yes, we had a discussion of that, The Unseen and the Unseen.
Yeah, yeah. And we had the discussion together, and it was very nice.
Oh, great.
Because this film is about a woman who talks with elves in like all her life, says so, and she tells the people where can they build and where they should live nature.
In fact, I had her on last week, so we can hear that discussion on our archive at klw.org. More information for the film Honeyland is at sffilm.org as well. Again, tomorrow evening at the Victoria Theater and Saturday afternoon at the Berkeley Film Center. Tamara Lubo, thanks so much for sharing a little bit about the film, and we look forward to catching the full cinematic splendor on the big screen.
Thank you very much.
Glad you again. Let's turn next to... let's get these mics adjusted a little bit. My next guest, also part of the San Francisco Film Festival, Luke Lorenzen. Luke has a film called Midnight Family, which is a disturbing yet poignant snapshot of one family's private ambulance service, the Ochoa family in Mexico City. We'll talk about that. Luke was a recent graduate from Stanford University's Department of Art and History, where he studied art history and film studies. His film Santa Cruz del Islote from 2014 was a documentary about a small and densely populated fishing community in Colombia. Has won awards at over 10 international film festivals, including the San Francisco International, Full Frame Documentary, Camden International, and Chicago International Festival. He's also part of the creative team behind the Netflix documentary series Last Chance You. And though he's originally from Connecticut, now lives on the road, most recently working on projects in Kansas, Mexico City, and Italy. Luke, welcome to our open airwaves.
Thank you.
And I hope you've had a good experience with the San Francisco Film Festival so far.
I have. They've kind of become a family of sorts to this project. They, much like Honeyland, came on with support really early on in making the film and came back with more support when we needed it towards the end. So really, really great people here.
Well, as I mentioned, this is about a private ambulance service in Mexico City, mm-hmm. which there are many. Apparently, some shocking statistics are involved right at the start of the film, that the government maintains a mere 45 ambulances for a population of 9 million people. And so these private ambulances are almost like, you know, you hear stories of the ambulance chasing lawyers. Mm-hmm. Well, here are ambulances chasing this scene, hearing police reports and rushing out to be the first on the scene so that they can basically make their living off of these unfortunate accidents. It's a fascinating portrait of one night. Or is it one night portrait or several nights?
It's several nights. Mm-hmm. We actually filmed over the course of 3 years, and I spent somewhere between 80 and 90 nights with this family in their ambulance, filming their way of life.
Hmm. And so, to top it all off, here are these families. Do you even know the degree of experience of medical training some of these families have?
The family in the film does have training. The father worked for the Mexican Red Cross for about 10 years, and through that work learned that he could open up his own business and try to kind of make a living on his own with his own, being his own boss. That being said, there are ambulances in Mexico that are run by people without training. Sometimes you'll see an ambulance that's being driven around by 15-year-olds who, you know, found a van and are out there trying to save people's lives and also trying to make a living.
And so they're literally racing to beat each other. Mm-hmm. You see almost like a street race.
Yeah, it's a competition. You know, the first person to get to the accident is the one that will have the chance to get the job.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to the subject?
I, just after graduating college, moved to Mexico City with a pretty close friend who had grown up there and was actually shooting an entirely different film. But through the process of being in Mexico City, I just met this family parked in front of my apartment building one morning. And, you know, there's even an 8-year-old who works in the ambulance, and I was just intrigued by this concept of, you know, family-run emergency medical service. And so I asked them if I could ride along for a night, and in that first kind of few hour experience with them, saw the whole movie. Then, like I said, spent the next 3 years getting to know them and filming with them.
And a lot of times, at least what we witnessed with the Ochoa family and their service, is that there's no set price for these things. Sometimes, you know, someone can be injured and they won't even offer any money to these people. And then there's a very, very touching and poignant scene where, you know, they've taken all the care that they could possibly take to get a victim to a private hospital that was nearby, only to then have to learn that the victim passed away, but they still have to ask a bereaved family for almost, you know, into paying them something, which is a little disturbing.
People, you know, maybe rightfully so, think that ambulances are something the government provides and that they should be free. And when this family does their work and asks for payment, people are often shocked, frustrated, and refuse to pay. They'll get paid for maybe 30% of all the work that they that they do. And that creates a really difficult situation where they are kind of looking for other ways to make a living that isn't getting money directly from the patients. And so it quickly becomes a very corrupt system. But an ambulance transport in New York City, for example, and it's probably the same here in San Francisco, can cost $1,500, $2,000.
Ripe for reform, not only here, but there, apparently. And so this has one more screening. You've enjoyed two screenings already. And the screening is tonight at 6 at the theater at Children's Creativity Museum, which is at 221 4th Street, 6 p.m. for that screening, sffilm.org, for more information about the remaining films in the film festival. Going strong, and I'm hoping you're enjoying your time in San Francisco and maybe stick down roots for at least a week or two, huh?
Yeah.
That's Luke Lorenzen, director of Midnight Family, the very disturbing yet poignant snapshot of one family's private ambulance service, the Ochoa family in Mexico City. Again, tonight's screening at 6 o'clock at the theater at the Children's Creativity Museum, which is at 221 4th Street. Thank you, filmmakers, for coming in and enjoy the film festival. I'm David LaTulip, and you're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Still to come, a discussion with Simona Young, guest conducting the San Francisco Symphony, and with Joe Kreider. Flyaway Productions presents the world premiere of The Weight Room, a site-specific dance honoring women with incarcerated loved ones. It's the brainchild of choreographer Joe Kreider, who is planning to develop two additional large-scale public art performances addressing the devastating effects of mass incarceration. Meet us quickly with Your Mercy, a residency project with MOAD, Bend the Arc, and Prison Renaissance, is slated to premiere in 2020. The following year, Flyaway Productions will mount a new dance inspired by restorative justice. These three works, beginning with The Weight Room, are entitled The Decarceration Trilogy, Dismantling the Prison Industrial Complex One Dance at a Time. Earlier this week on Your Call, KALW's public affairs call-in show hosted by Rose Aguilar, Joe Kreider was part of a panel of guests to explore incarceration and its effects on families. Here is part of that conversation.
People are incarcerated in the United States. This country has the highest number of people in prison in the world. As a result, one in four women and nearly one in two black women has at one point had a family member in prison. In her new aerial dance performance, The Weight Room, today's guest, choreographer and dancer Joe Kreider, blends oral history, dance, music, and public art to explore the physical, psychic, and emotional burdens incarceration places on women with loved ones who are behind bars. The Weight Room is the most personal work Joe Kreider has undertaken since she founded Flyaway Productions back in 1996. When she announced The Weight Room, she said, quote, "I have a partner who was incarcerated, and I have lived the last 8 years wedged between the fracture of incarceration and the hopefulness of dance making," end quote. Joe Kreider and her amazing team partnered with Oakland-based Essie Justice Group. That's an organization with a mission to harness the collective power of women with incarcerated loved ones to end mass incarceration's harm to women and communities. If you are in the Bay Area, I hope you can see this performance. The Weight Room runs April 19th to the 27th at 1125 Market Street in San Francisco, a vacant lot opposite UN Plaza at the Civic Center. The Weight Room will then travel to Richmond, California for two performances on May 17th and 18th in partnership with the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts. Joe Kreider is a San Francisco-based choreographer with a background in political science. She is the founder and artistic director of Flyaway Productions. That's an apparatus-based dance company that explores the range and power of female physicality and advances social issues in the public realm. And Joe joins us in studio. I should also mention that Joe is a fellow of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Hi, Joe. Thank you for coming in. Congratulations on the fellowship.
Thank you, Rose. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. You have been on the show many times talking about the amazing work that you do. And this is the most personal work that you have undertaken since you found Flyaway back in 1996. Why did you decide to pursue this issue, given that it's so personal for you?
It's hard to describe why I decided to do this. I think a lot of it has to do with coming into contact with Essie and understanding how much of a feminist and gender justice issue it is to run into incarceration as a woman, not as a woman incarcerated, but as a woman with an incarcerated loved one, how much that's a feminist issue. And to have lived it and to understand it from inside my body, as well as intellectually and socially, I think that was the catharsis, was seeing my experience through a feminist lens to pull a whole community of women fairly invisible in the general culture through the arts. And I felt like, wow, I see a way to do this. That it includes my story is difficult and emotional, but it's also been a lovely experience of my own work. For example, Pamela Z interviewed all of us, Jasmine and Anita and several other women for the project, and she also interviewed me. So I was suddenly on the other side of the tape recorder. And
what was that like for you?
It was kind of tweaky and freaky, but interesting. And my voice is in the piece. And I didn't think she was going to put my voice in the piece. I said, oh, don't use my voice. My voice is in the art. It's fine. But she did. She went behind my back and used my voice. And so it's it doesn't upset me as much as I thought it would. And it's interesting to be a subject in your own work. I've learned something.
And Pamela Z, you've worked with her on many of your pieces. Mm-hmm. She's an amazing sound engineer. And so much more.
Well, she's a composer.
Composer.
She's a composer, sound engineer, technician. She's one of the first, in some ways, only black women in new music. And she's just an amazing artist. And we've been working together since 1996. So we have a long habit of working with oral history. She works with text as sound better than anyone I know. And she's done an amazing job at integrating the interviews into art.
In all of your performances, you connect with a local group working on the issue. And how did you connect with the Essie Justice Group?
Well, I came across Essie because from a very personal place of feeling really desperate and going on the internet and saying, what's out there for me? And I found Essie. And because I was living in such a state of trauma when my husband was on the inside, I didn't actually connect with them with any depth until he came home. Because I just didn't have the bandwidth to do the one more thing. But I have now connected with them, and I went through the 9-week healing course, healing to advocacy course, and now I'm working to engage on the political side with Essie. Essie is an amazing organization because they have this healing to advocacy model, and you need both sides. You can't do just one or the other and be an effective American, I think.
On the Essie Justice Group website, it says, quote, although millions of people experience the effects of mass incarceration, social support for women with incarcerated loved ones can be hard to find due to the intense stigma surrounding incarceration. The result is isolation, end quote. Joe, what can people expect?
We have designed a set that spins. We've designed a set where the floor drops out from under you. My experience, myself, and what I've culled from other women with incarcerated loved ones is that destabilization is at the center of our daily lives. And so we designed a set where destabilization is in the engineering and is fundamental to every moment of creation of the choreography. When I was testing the set when it was being built, I kept falling off it. And it felt like such an apt physical expression of what women with incarcerated loved ones live through. I say something when I talk about the piece, which is that being in proximity to the prison system, it The prison system asks women to be in collusion with the very system that is simultaneously bringing you down. Mm. And it's an extremely uncomfortable position because you want to support your loved ones. So you put money on the books and you pay for the phone calls to the best of your ability. And if they're in the state system, you can send packages. So you participate knowing that the system is dehumanizing, degrading your loved one and your own family. And it's just an incredibly uncomfortable thing.
And you talked about the phone call fees. There's so many costs involved. The commissary bills, attorney fees, bail bond debt, the visits, because in so many cases, prisons are far away from cities, in some cases a 5-hour drive, and it can be expensive to visit. And, you know, as you say, Joe, we talk about these issues a lot on this show, but until you've really been there, you don't really understand just how difficult it is to navigate.
Well, it's constant. My husband was incarcerated for 5 years, and there was constant crisis, crisis after crisis after crisis within the incarceration experience, starting at the pretrial situation through the sentencing. He was moved to Texas halfway through for no reason. So there's a constancy to the trauma that you have no choice but to navigate. You know, you don't give up. You can't give up. You have other family members. You have your loved ones. So there's a constancy to the trauma that is ongoing and daily. And so your world can get extremely small. And I know that that happened for me. My world got very, very small. The piece is unlike anything I've ever made. Most of my dances happen on walls. And for this project, we've built a self-sustaining set where you can fly without being attached to anything structural. It's a piece of engineering brilliance by Sean Riley. Pamela Z has done an incredible job taking the heart and essence and good and value of the women who've told us their stories and turning it, transforming it into something that the imagination can sync up with. We're on this lot, this big empty lot right off Market Street where we're facing the federal building on one side, UN Plaza on the other. If I get on my tippy toes, I can see the courthouse where my husband was convicted from the lot. So it's a very powerful sight. I feel like we've done a lot of things right. Now we just need our audience.
Wow. And just quickly, Joe, what response have you received from organizations that are working to end mass incarceration?
Well, we've done a lot of outreach, and hopefully they're coming to the show. And we're doing two workshops with the public, two master classes. They're on the website. We have some folks from Project What coming to that workshop. Those are folks whose those are teens whose parents are or were incarcerated. So check out the master classes if you want to come do some dancing and come to the show.
And my thanks to Rose Aguilar for that conversation from your call earlier this week. More information at flyawayproductions.com. Simone Young makes her San Francisco Symphony debut tonight through Saturday with a program of Ravel and Rimsky-Korsakov with guest pianist Louis Lorty. Having been on various podiums as a conductor and music director since 1985, you'd say it's about time, and I'd agree with you. With Ravel's Pavan pour un enfant défunt on the program, given the recent fire that devastated Notre Dame Cathedral, there may be a bit more emotional heft to these concerts than when they were programmed months ago. I have caught up with the conductor in the Davies Symphony Hall green room earlier this week.
Maestro Young, welcome to Open Air.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're a Sydney native, guest conducting engagements on the podium and in the pit for opera companies around the world. Just where is home for you now?
Well, home at the moment is the south of the UK, in a lovely part of the world that is about 40 miles south of London, just where the green hills start rolling and it's all extremely idyllic. But home is also still Sydney, even though I don't spend much time out there anymore.
We talked about the challenges of modern conducting and travel, especially not knowing which time of day it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real challenge, and particularly having Australia as a key part of my schedule because, well, my mum's still there, but I also have a long-standing relationship with the various orchestras there, most particularly Sydney. I make a number of trips out there, and it really throws your system out of whack. But I do enjoy the travel now. My kids are out of the house, and I love new cultures. I'm a real foodie. And I love visiting art galleries, museums, and I'm a big fan of nature. So if I can combine the work with a little bit of time off every now and then, that for me is the ideal mix.
Well, it sounds like you should have been considered for San Francisco then, given our food, given our nature, given our culture. We hope you have some downtime here in San Francisco. Well, I believe you had sort of a role reversal in that your husband was a Mr. Mom while you were jetting around the globe. And how is that going, and how are the kids?
Yes. You know, there are a lot of things in life that are just simply serendipitous. I could have married a maths teacher or a science teacher, and then I probably would have spent my whole life in Sydney. But I married a foreign language teacher, somebody who is just as infected with the travel bug as I am. And languages are a bit of a family obsession. So when we up sticks and moved to Europe in 1987, ostensibly for a couple of years, and we find ourselves still there now, that all worked fine. And then when we had kids, my job was, yes, it's not even a 12-hour day. It's all-encompassing, and it's 7 days a week. And so Greg went on to first part-time work, and then when I took on the Hamburg Opera House and the Philharmonic there, then he stayed at home, looked after our younger daughter, who was then still in school. I'm a double grandma now. Oh. My elder daughter is 31 and has two little girls. My younger daughter's only 21. She's just finished uni.
Wow, fantastic. We have to inevitably talk about the questions about being a woman on the podium. Do you sense a generational shift and perhaps now find it easier to be on the podium as a conductor rather than as a woman conductor?
Well, for me, it was never an issue. I mean, I've been doing this job since 1985. It's going to be 34 years this September. And in those days, I didn't know any other women conductors. I just knew conductors. And for me, it has always been about the music and not about myself. And the gender issue is something that is perhaps a visual issue for audiences and orchestras. But, in fact, if your focus is 100% on the music, then gender becomes completely irrelevant, and that's always been my attitude to it. I'm delighted to see the current new crop of young women conductors taking on these roles, just as the same way as, a few years ago, Vienna Philharmonic took the decision to take women into the orchestras because they said, we've got to take the best musicians, and these girls are outplaying the competition. So it's all about finding the best musicians and the best artists, best interpreters. And gender is, for me, just it doesn't come into the equation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you've been conducting professionally since 1985. Just now, this past January, you made your debut with the LA Philharmonic. This is your debut with the San Francisco Symphony. Is this part of some sort of Australian invasion? Or what actually led to your engagement here finally?
Okay, well, I conducted a little bit in the States in the 90s, mainly at the Met in New York, because opera was very much my home base for many, many years. And then in the late 90s, I took on the obligation of being music and artistic director of this opera in Sydney, the Opera Australia. And with a young child, Lucy was born in 97, just the thought of working on four continents. You know, I was working in Japan, I was working in the States, so most of my work was Europe and Australia. I had to basically just sort of cut the States and Japan out of the equation. Now the kids are out of the house. I finished the jobs in Sydney and then in Hamburg, and I'm performing a lot more regularly now in the States and in Japan. I have a number of debuts coming up, which is kind of funny at my age. On the other hand, I've been conducting the Vienna Phil for 25 years, and there are a lot of conductors my age who are still waiting to make their debuts there.
No kidding, yeah. You mentioned such amazing opera work you've been doing at the Met in Sydney, multiple ring cycles in Vienna, Berlin. Are you in favor of the more contemporary or traditional interpretations of the ring and opera in general?
Look, I think it's you have to walk a very fine line, and this was something that when I was running the opera in Sydney and the opera in Hamburg, you have to deal with, to a big extent, audience expectations. Now, the audience expectation in Germany is that opera is a living art form, and the director's role is not to tell the story, but to interpret the story and make it relevant for contemporary audiences. Now, for my taste, there are some directors who do that absolutely superbly, make the performance relevant without damaging the material. And then there are some directors who place themselves actually above the work, and I just don't work with them anymore. On the other hand, there's nothing more beautiful than doing a gorgeous old traditional Tosca or Madame Butterfly. But then I saw a fantastic new Tosca that was very exciting in its exploration of the complexities of the power struggle in the second act between Scarpia and Tosca and the politicized artist of Cavaradossi, and it made the whole drama much more political.
Whose production was that, Yrigal?
I knew you were going to ask me
that's
that.
All right. I think I recall it as well, because it was visually very interesting as well.
Yes, and you can be contemporary and opulent, and you can be very stark and still spectacularly moving as well. It's all about good direction, not necessarily whether it's contemporary or old style. If the performers are given the direction to make the story relevant to a contemporary audience and yet are given the freedom to be able to sing the music the way it needs to be sung, then you're in for an exciting night of music theater.
Your discography is heavy on the Bruckner, Mahler, Brahms side. What's drawn you to want to record the works of these particular masters? In other words, what do you feel that you particularly are bringing to the interpretations?
Well, the Bruckner series came about because a number of years ago I had some interesting conversations with William Carrigan, who's the musicologist who brought out the critical edition of Bruckner's Second Symphony. And Bruckner revised and actually completely rewrote big chunks of both the second, third, fourth, and eighth symphonies. And once I had become acquainted with these early versions, I felt convinced that this was a music that spoke to me very directly. I don't conduct the later versions of these works anymore. I only do the early versions. And Bruckner was a huge Wagner fan. I mean, he hero worshipped Wagner. And with my 25-odd years of experience in the Wagner operatic repertoire, I feel I perhaps am able to bring something to the Bruckner recordings that is more directly connected to the operatic references. The same with Mahler. I mean, Mahler, and of course the other thing was the Hamburg connection, of course, because in Hamburg, Mahler had been music director. Brahms had conducted this orchestra. Some of my great heroes, musical heroes, Klemperer, my brain's gone, MASH, it's the jet lag. But, you know, there have been great conductors had been my predecessors, particularly in the first half of the 20th century in Hamburg. And so when you take on that role, you carry a certain responsibility to continue that heritage and to take it further. And the orchestra in Hamburg had never recorded the Brahms symphonies, which I found astonishing, given that this was Brahms' home city. The hall sits on Brahms' Platz. I spent a lot of time in researching also researching the Bruckner, and with my strong connection to Vienna, which is the other great Bruckner and Brahms city and Mahler city, it seemed a very natural way to go.
I look forward to exploring those recordings. Which brings us to this program, sort of a crowd pleaser, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade and two works by Ravel, the Pavan pour un enfant de defunt and the jazz-inspired piano concerto in G with the achingly beautiful second movement. Mm. Have you worked with pianist Louis Lortie before?
Yes, actually, we've worked quite a lot together. We first did this concerto together more than 20 years ago in Sydney, in fact. Most recently, we worked together in Switzerland, and he'll be playing with me in Sydney again in August. So, yeah, he's a good friend as well as a fabulous musician whose artistry I admire enormously because he just stands above the work and can say so much spontaneously with it. Yeah, it is a crowd pleaser, this program. I mean, the Ravel piano concerto, as you say, with that gorgeous second movement, but also very immediately punchy first and third movements, very jazzy. It's extremely appealing. And the Scheherazade was one of my big favorites of my teenage years. It was very much in fashion in the 70s and has kind of gone out of fashion a little bit, but it's a great vehicle for the orchestra. I mean, almost every instrument has something virtuosic to play. Great vehicle for the concertmaster.
Flutist.
And the Ravel is one of my favorites. And, of course, the tragic events of this week with the destruction of most of the spectacularly beautiful Notre Dame means that this Pavane for a dead princess is going to carry a lot of extra weight and a lot of extra emotion, I think. It's one of the things I find fascinating about live music and why live music is so important, because the collective experience of an audience informs the reception of the work, which means the Pavane that you hear this week will feel very different to a Pavane you heard last week because the collective experience of the audience has changed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, even though the notes on the page are exactly the same, the emotional input both from the orchestra and myself, but also from the participating audience, will be different, making it a different work of art. And that's the magic of live performance.
Well, we look forward to these performances, and we do hope that you spend a little downtime here in San Francisco, get your bearings again, and come back and see us soon.
Thank you very much.
Performances are tonight, Friday, and Saturday at 8. Information at sfsymphony.org. With some of the Ravel Pavane in the background, I'm David LaTulipe, thanking you for joining us for this week's Open Air. My thanks to Neil Swinkels as well for producing the show. The shows are archived at kalw.org. Send me a note at david@kalw.org.